You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hello there, my name is Sue Nelson and this is the Food Talk Show and I'm joined by my fellow presenter Guy Routledge. Good afternoon, Guy.
Good afternoon, Sue. Sometimes you're looking lovely today. I thought I'd just throw you there.
I'm stunned. You have never, ever said that, ever.
Well, you keep throwing me off by saying, oh, my gorgeous co-host, blah, 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 which is a load of rubbish. Fortunately, this is a radio programme. Yeah. No one can see what we look like.
We do both have a face for radio. That's absolutely true.
Sorry to throw you there.
Well, also, I'm that age where if I work for the BBC, they get rid of me because I'd be too old as a woman presenter. They sort
of kick disgraceful.
They kick you out after 50, don't they?
I've not worked there, so I don't know.
Well, we've not reached that age either. So
well, that is true.
They, would you?
Couple of years ago.
You're listening to the Food Talk Show. And today's guest, we have Danny Kingston, who's the Food Urchin blogger. Hi, Danny.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Yes, we know you very well because you won a Food Talk Awards this year. The best blogger.
Yes,
Our esteemed panel of judges. And we had quite a few blogs that we all had a good look at.
Absolutely.
And yours was the one that actually won pretty much hands down, really.
Well, that's very nice to hear.
Because they said it wasn't just about, you know, writing about food. And it wasn't just sort of like a self-indulgent thing about food. You learn stuff when you read your blog, I would say.
Yeah, there's loads of stories there. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's when I'm writing and when I'm coming up with ideas for the blog and what have you, underneath the level, I'm always trying to think, well, what can I actually tell my readers, so to speak? What can I get from this? I may well dress it up with a lot of rambunctious kind of nonsense along the way, but I like to think underneath the envelope, so to speak, they're actually going to come away with something. Like, oh, wow. I've discovered something new there.
There's some great stories. We'll talk a bit more about those in a bit.
Yeah, we're definitely going to talk a bit more about those in a bit. So that's Danny Kingston of Food Urchin Blog, and I do suggest you have a good old read of that. We're also joined by Luke Fernandez of Sugarwise. Hi, Luke.
Hi there. Hi.
How are you doing? You all right?
Yeah, not too bad.
Good. And we're going to learn all about what you're doing in terms of, well, sugar's quite topical at the moment.
Very topical indeed.
We had a great sugary programme last week, didn't we?
Well, chocolatey.
Chocolatey, sugary.
Well, and we had the energy drink as well, which was not sugary, yeah, but, you know, packed full of good stuff.
But I'm looking out across the studio, not a single thing to eat or drink this week. It always makes me slightly sad.
We've got water. That's all we've got. But it does mean that our lovely listeners don't have to listen to us,
you know,
chomping away and talking about chocolate for half an hour. So
Danny, you're what you would describe as a food adventurer. You're a home grower, you're a supper club host and writer of the somewhat quirky Epicurean blog, I like that word.
It's a good word.
Food Urchin.
Yes.
Now, when you're not busy digging holes to pit roast lamb, or hanging marrows in tights to make rum, or foraging for snails in your garden to throw in your paella, you're often left in charge of a pair of cheeky twins.
Who
make quite a mess in the kitchen.
Yes, they do.
Take after you?
You were just moaning about them just before you came here.
I said to a guy I was up early this morning, feverishly trying to finish off a bit of copy for a website that I'm writing for, and I got up at 5 and I was on a roll, and then all of a sudden it's daddy, we're up now. I was like, oh god, please get out of here, you know. But so whilst they are wonderful and I do love them, there's times when I do wish they was out of the way. But they're little foodies themselves.
Good.
I've kind of always encourage them to dip their fingers in, to, you know, lick the spoon, so to speak, and have a good old crack at everything, really.
Yeah.
And I'm quite proud to say that on their diet they'll eat anchovies, blue cheese.
That's really
brilliant.
Good.
Brilliant.
Yeah, you know, a whole host of different
things. Kids always used to stand them on chairs so that they could, you know, reach the kitchen.
Yeah.
And they always used knives, even when they were 2 or 3, like really sharp knives.
Really?
My dad used to go, don't let that child use a really sharp knife. Yeah, but if they're brought up with using sharp knives.
Well, no, that's
then,
right. That's
you know,
right.
They're used to them. They don't suddenly.
How old are
get,
they?
They're twins, so they're 9. They were 9 this year, so coming along nicely. So. And you mentioned knives. I actually would keep them. I kept mine away from knives, but for a long time, like we had the kind of sword of destiny that was in our kitchen. This wooden sword, that,
Damocles.
Yeah, well, that's even better. But we used to wedge that down in between so they couldn't get access to the knives, because that was something that used to worry. So used to worry me. So you was very very bold.
Well, they're not my fingers, are they? So I wasn't actually that bothered, to be honest with you. I've always brought them up, standing on chairs, making stuff. And I'm really quite proud of the fact that they're in their late 20s, that they just do cook from scratch. And it just is perfectly natural to them, really.
Yeah.
But it's not a dying everybody. Art these days,
well,
isn't it?
Not everybody has the time, and not everybody possibly has the money to do that. But always from day one. And still my favourite, actually, is Sunday lunch, where everybody comes along, somebody's peeling potatoes, somebody's doing, everybody's chatting brilliant. Together. I think that family thing's brilliant.
Yeah, actually. Yeah. I mean, it's quite, in some respect, as you describe that scene, it seems all of a sudden a little bit old-fashioned to me. But I still hate them.
I mean, I don't like them that much. I don't do it that often.
But that's something I used to do with my parents. I distinctly remember being in the living room with a bowl of, like, a big pot and of water and potatoes. Yeah. And you'd always, the peelings and the potatoes always go in the same pot. And
exactly.
That kind of, you conjured up some memories there. But
But
I do have the children. I do get the children involved myself. I think it's very important.
I think it's really helpful. And I'm sure Luke will have some stuff to say about that after the break in terms of educating kids on what they're eating and joining in and cooking is a big point. Big part of that, I think.
I mean, sugar-wise, would say that not everyone is going to cook from fresh every day. They're not going to cook from scratch every day. So it's a balance, really, and it is important to replace your staple snack foods with something that's still a snack food, but is going to be healthier for you from a sugar perspective. Entirely in favour of people teaching their kids to cut things up properly and be familiar with knives and be familiar with the kitchen so that they can grow up to be independent adults.
So, Danny, your food urchin blog. Now, today, when I've had a good old look, there's some stuff around beer can chicken.
Beer can.
Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, beer can chicken has... over the last few years, it was kind of one of those gimmicky things to do. Depending on your point of view, actually.
Some people call it Stella Chicken.
Stella Chicken.
Stella Artois.
I can see that. This blog post that I just did recently was actually, I found some copy from... sometimes you can write some stuff and it kind of goes by the wayside and you don't quite finish it off. And you think, oh no, I must push this back out there. So that's where that came as an experiment with beer can chicken. But unfortunately, I didn't have all the right equipment that is needed.
You didn't have any beer?
I had plenty of beer. Maybe I had too much beer because ideally, you need to, with a barbecue and beer can chicken, you need to use the indirect cooking method. Okay, so you're not going to be cooking your chicken directly over the charcoal heat.
That'd be great, wouldn't it? Because essentially, you have to stick a can up its.
Stick a can up
the opening. Is that the right word?
No, that sounds worse than anything.
Worse.
Actually. Yeah, that sounds absolutely horrendous, Guy.
Stick the can inside the chicken.
And the chicken's got a little bit of beer. And the theory of that then is that basically keeps it moist on the inside and all that sort of stuff.
You're up in the moisture levels in the barbecue.
That sounds pretty bad too.
Yeah.
So moist is sounding quite bad.
Never ever mention the word moist when it comes to food. Sorry. And that's what you're doing. But like I said, you need the indirect cooking method. And I don't have one of those kind of kettle and barbecues. I had to cobble together this kind of piece of kit using as many trays as I could put together, like using foil everywhere. I had the bricks going on and whatever. But the one big problem I had, I didn't have a receptacle to cover my chicken, which is obviously what you need to do to retain the heat
and the moisture.
So what I decided I should do, I had an old galvanized mop bucket that was just deep enough, so I went out in the garden, I knocked the handle off that and that's what I stuck over my chicken, and it did a good job.
So amazing. Your wife just spilt something in the kitchen, she's then gone to clear it up and you've nicked it and taken the handle off.
Exactly, yeah.
This seems to be a bit of a running theme with some of the things that you've done in the past and then written about. I was trawling through some of your back catalogue earlier today, and is it true that you once burnt down your garden fence?
Very nearly. I refute that statement. Actually, it didn't quite burn down.
I was going for comic effect.
No. My wife's response was anything but comic because the fence did go up. Basically, I was doing some pit. Barbecuing, basically, where you dig a big hole in the
put a
fire in it, and you're cooking it, basically. But rather
I'm
than
so
having,
so glad I'm not married to you. Honestly, that would drive me nuts.
I don't know. Just I quite like the idea of
I'm
some...
off love for the next couple of hours, and you go out and you dug a big hole in the garden and it's set light.
The idea of some slow roasted meat, though. Oh, you can definitely come round.
It's fantastic method of cooking, but you need to make sure you do it in the centre of the garden.
So not nearby.
Right in the middle of the lawn.
Whereas I dug this right next to. I dug my hole right next to the fence, and of course I didn't quite realise it was going to go up, but quite as fast as it did. And I always remember my wife kind of looking out, or she was standing by the patio, like, screaming her head off, and I've got this hose in my hand, like watering down the fence panel, saying, "It's okay, darling, nothing to see here. It's all right, don't worry." And yeah,
amazing.
You have to be careful.
It kind of reminds me of that opening sequence to Men Behaving Badly, when you've got the guys there with the barbecue, and they open up, and it's got all the beer inside, and then the fence catches fire. Showing my age there.
Should we move on to something less boy and less manly?
It has got
I don't know. This feels quite good for a change. Yeah.
Favourite blog post? You've had a good old look this morning. Sorts of stuff. And the stuff that you like titles, to write about in yours.
The titles of Danny's don't happen to have stuck in my head, but there was a really nice story of you went to visit some island off the coast of Scotland, I think it was.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you
that
kind
was
of
recently.
Discovered all this wonderful stuff from times gone by.
Yeah, so this was up in Ayrshire, and it's now you put me on the spot, I've got to remember the name.
Somewhere on my screen.
But essentially, it's where Isla
Craig.
Isla Craig, of course, I should remember that. But essentially, it's a solid lump of granite, and they used to quarry the granite on the island. Mm. And it's this granite actually is the stuff that goes into curling stones and what have you. Yeah. But so there used to be quite a community on the island of these really hard Scottish people who would, you know, hammer away at the cliff face and take all this granite away. But slowly as a resource, it dwindled and the community got smaller and smaller and smaller. And eventually I think the island was abandoned. I mean, don't quote me on this, but I think the island was abandoned in maybe the 70s or early 80s. That was when they finished there. But they left behind like the living quarters. And when I was able to visit the island, this was part of a kind of a press trip that I'd gone on. It was just amazing. You know, when you kind of go into this landscape and there's this kind of almost dystopian kind of feel about things things have just been left to rack and ruin. And it was just amazing seeing these kind of living quarters, these apartments that have been left open to the elements, and the elements have slowly but surely degraded it. And everyone was, the other guys who was on the trip were taking the mickey out of me because I'd turned into this investigative kind of photography reporter, snapping away. And yeah, I was like, yeah, this is going to be an exhibition, darling. Mm. You know, I'm going to do something with this. But no, the photo, it's something that I don't do that often in terms of kind of photo montage or sort of how would you describe it?
Like a photo story.
Photo story, yeah. But yeah, it's like, oh no, I've definitely got to do something like that because I snapped so many photos and I found it quite fascinating. It'd be good to do a film there.
Yeah, amazing. Like, such
atmosphere.
It
sounds a little bit spooky though.
It
was spooky. And I mean, there was obviously some remains of other bits and pieces on the island that you couldn't be quite sure of what they were. Mm. But
probably somebody's old auntie that they got rid of.
Yeah, well, I think
nobody's realised. It's been there since 19, whatever. So what has drawn you to writing about food? Why did that start, Danny?
I think, I started my blog up about 9 years ago now. And at the time, it was all that kind of stuff was very much in its infancy. People going online writing about food. You had lots of forums going on. And there I was kind of just it was the dawn of social media a little bit really, and I was kind of cottoning onto it all and reading other people's blog posts, and I've always been passionate about food myself, always been interested. I've always enjoyed cooking, going to the restaurants, doing different bits and pieces, visiting producers and what have you. And it was almost like I was reading all these blogs and said, well, I want a slice of that action. I want to have a crack at this. Coming in with a very hobbyist kind of angle still, you know. But it was a nice just to finally find a space where I could, I don't know, tell stories, where I could communicate in that way. It's quite, prior to that, I didn't really have any kind of aspirations to be a writer or to, you know, but it's interesting. Once you get plugged in into that kind of world, it feeds itself, so to speak. And it grew and grew and I kind of began thinking more and more about food, about what I wanted to do with food, and you know, finding out different bits and pieces about it, really.
So it started as like a creative outlet, and yeah, just like simply doing it as a hobby for a bit of fun.
Simple creative outlet. It still very much is, actually.
The Food Urchin blog.
Yeah, the Food Urchin.
But you are now primarily like a writer by trade, or writer for hire?
Writer for hire, so to speak. I've been freelance now for about, coming up for 5 months now, where I've kind of decided to quit the day job, so to speak, and focus fully on this. So lots of different bits and pieces have come out of it, really, out of the blog. You know, you kind of because you're putting it out there specifically on social. I mean, social media has been fantastic for me.
You've got to do that because otherwise all you're doing is broadcasting, as opposed to creating a community of people who are joining in and engaging.
And I
think I see quite a lot of blogs, but they're just somebody's, I don't know, that they are just using it as a creative outlet, as you said, Guy, and they're
some
not
of them
creating
are,
a buzz around
I
it.
Don't know. So we obviously work with a lot of writers and creatives and contributors on the Food Rush, and we've recently kind of changed tack slightly and are now working with, you know, with more of those kind of people and with a slightly different focus on the content. And as part of our research to work out what other people are doing and also to go and find the, you know, the influencers and the potential contributors, we've been trawling around trying to find, you know, the gems in amongst all of the noise. And it's funny
By that you mean what, the best writers?
Yeah, the best writers or the people with the, you know, the most interesting point of view and stuff like that. So we're trying to bring together as many different voices as we can to talk about, you know, food and family from all sorts of different angles. Because it's, you know, as we started off talking about today, you know, that idea of getting kids into the kitchen and experimenting with stuff and becoming comfortable with food is, you know, incredibly important. But then also it's, you know, it's a great way to bring the whole family together. And, you know, all these stories happen around the dinner table, even though so many people don't even have a dining table anymore. But still, that's that essence of that. And we found that there's, you know, there's a lot of blogs out there, or a lot of people writing or putting stuff on social media. But some of them, they're either doing it as a hobby and it's kind of, and it's quite small, or they've just sold out and they're doing all these, you know, weird brand partnerships with, you know, with car makers.
I'm really sorry about this, and this is, I guess it is a bit controversial, but when we did the Food Talk Awards and that was the first time I really, really, really looked at a whole number of blogs, I was quite disappointed, I have to say. You know, there were a good handful that were really good. So when we did the judging, we had some really good things to look at.
Yeah, absolutely.
But underneath that, there was a whole tranche of not very interesting or not very good. Or, as you say, if people want... You see, you can't really make a living out. It's quite difficult
to make
a living.
It's very, very challenging,
And therefore, the people who are good do tend to sell it, because if they want to make a living out of it, they've got to go find some sponsorship, really, haven't they?
Yeah, so either sponsorship or they do these kind of brand partnerships. But I mean, we had Helen Graves on the show a few months ago now, and she's done some fantastic
Helen
stuff.
Graves,
she's
great.
She's done great. Yeah. She's brilliant. I think, coming back to like what you're saying, I suppose part of the problem is that all of a sudden, in a certain way, becomes quite superficial in terms of brand partnership and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's just a regurgitation of their message, so to speak, or their own brand or what have you. And that is a kind of that's a tripping point for a lot of bloggers, I would say, because you're not actually selling a unique kind of point of view or whatever.
And people won't trust you.
And they don't trust you,
because as soon as I see ads on stuff, I just switch off, actually.
I do think, though, you can, if you can work around that, you just have to use your imagination just a bit more. Mm. I don't think it's kind of something to be shunned or have you. But you do have to certainly use your imagination. You have to think, well, in terms of engaging your reader, or even what's going to be attractive to yourself when you're going to be reading it. You have to think, what's the angle here? What's the story?
We've spent quite a lot of money on the Food Talk Show website. So, you know, foodtalk.co.uk. I will never take sponsorship because we won't be allowed to do what we want.
Yeah.
And also, I think people will go on there and actually think, well, do they really believe in that, or are they just saying that because, you know, I don't know, Sainsbury's or somebody is paying them?
Yeah.
And there's always that in somebody's mind. Well, do they really mean that, or are they just promoting? I mean, we have people on here on this program because we really think they're interesting and they're doing amazing stuff, don't we?
Yeah.
No other reason, really. And that's great. But if we took advertising, I do think that people may question why you'd be here, for example, or why Sugarwise is here.
No, and
question our integrity. And I'm very lucky because I run a business where we fund this.
Yeah.
I suppose I treat it like a charity, really. because we really want to promote food and we want people to be able to tell their stories.
Yeah.
But that makes us quite unusual. It's quite hard to find a financial model that will allow you to do and say what the hell you want and have who you want and not worry about sponsorship. Yeah. And you're struggling with that concept, aren't you? You're finding it hard for Food Rush. Is what business model should we have in order to make sure we can get all this amazing information out?
Yeah,
but how do I make it work? How do I pay my rent?
Well, that's always a challenge. It's something that we kind of spent a lot of time working on at the beginning of this year. And I think there is a big difference between advertising and sponsorship. And I think there is working with people who you believe in to help them do more of what they do and to, you know, get them in front of the people that they want to and need to be in front of. And so we're definitely doing a part of that kind of stuff. But then, you know, the bread and butter of our business is consultancy behind the scenes. You know, so working with these brands to help them embrace technology and to embrace content and, you know, that this age of content marketing. So that's where we're putting the majority of
our
work.
Retire.
Well, I think mine
with a bit of
money.
And then I'm just going to write whatever I want in a blog and I can just say whatever I want and not worry about it.
Well, that is the beauty of it, is having that control.
Well, judging from your Heston blog post.
Don't tell anybody about that. God, blimey.
That just keeps coming back around, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, but if I can just explain that, though, if you wouldn't mind. I mean, I think what Heston does is incredible, but it annoys me that it's on television as a, you know, date, you know, as a popular evening thing, because I really seriously think it's putting people off cooking. And I'm sure that he wouldn't want that. I don't think he'd even want that. I love his restaurants. I love to go and eat in his restaurants. I think what he does is incredible. But I don't like it on the television because I think we're getting a whole generation of people who think, wow, that is so hard. I'm not even going to go in the kitchen. And I just think that's the most awful message you can give. Really.
I find it really inspiring because I just love weird and wacky stuff.
That's because you can cook.
I'm a bit special.
Special needs. But that's because you can cook, though, Guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's putting off people who want to do basic stuff and really, you know, really making it difficult for them. But they're just thinking it's a difficult thing to do. And cooking isn't a difficult thing to
do. No, it's not. You can do so much with, you know, if you can get hold of really good quality ingredients, you can just, you know, you can do something so simple that tastes so great. And I guess that's the kind of stuff that you write about, Danny, is that you travel around, you're a food adventurer, you go and find all these wonderful things.
Yeah.
And then I guess you come bring them back and try and either recreate them or, you know, you don't do that classic thing of putting out recipes so much. It's much more about the story about things, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always been very much about the story.
And your disasters, by the sound.
I mean, at the end of the day,
everyone loves that, don't they?
It's kind of that self-depreciating kind of aspect that people kind of do like as well, you know, because...
Well, it's honest, just like the food. It's, you know, it's you telling a story. Sometimes it's a great success and then sometimes you burn down the garden fence.
My mind's always looking around for, you know, I'm always looking around for different things to try out, basically. And if they're a success, they're great and I will, you know, sing my praises. But equally, if it's gone by the wayside, then it's going to make for a great story still, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, jolly good. And I would advise anybody, you know, if you're interested in some of these interesting adventures of Danny, they should go to foodurgin.com. We're going to take a little break for a couple of minutes and we'll be back with you. We're going to definitely be talking to Luke Fernandez about the interesting, I suppose, slightly controversial subject of sugar.
Yes, very well.
Topical for sure.
Topical? Let's say topical. Let's say topical. Okay, so we're going to have a break. In the meantime, we're going to listen to John Chilton, and he makes beer out of rice and quinoa. There we go.
I'm here with John. So John, can you tell me a little bit about the product?
I can, Harry, yes. So we're brewing with malted rice and quinoa. We're bringing over a malted rice from California. There's a brewer out there whose wife was diagnosed celiac, and he started to develop a beer that they could both drink, and he started malting rice in his backyard. He's now got a production unit and he's supplying gluten-free breweries across the USA. We brought the malted rice over to the UK about 2.5 years ago and started to develop beers based on that malted rice. And we're now at the stage where we went into production in January and we've been trading since January. We've got about 50, 60 outlets up in the northeast primarily, also the northwest. And we're starting to work on getting some outlets in the London market as well.
That's great to hear. I mean, obviously we're here at the Allergy Show today and, well, so far I've walked around and you're the only beer company that are here. I'm guessing that's a good sign.
There are actually other beer companies here. Greens are here and probably a couple of others. But there's not so many people doing the naturally gluten-free route. A lot of the brewers are brewing with malted barley and then de-glutenising, whereas we're starting from a point of having a naturally gluten-free grain. So we're not taking anything out, we're not putting anything in to take out gluten. So we've got something that we think is a great tasting beer that just happens to be gluten-free as well.
It's interesting because obviously when you think of sort of food intolerance, you think of food and you think of people that need their staple to survive, like their bread, cheese, chocolate, whatever, it's like your main products, but you don't really consider beer that much. So how, sort of, with people knowing more and more now that they've got intolerances, do you think the market's only going to go one way?
The market's only going to get bigger, and all of the research shows that. You know, more people are being diagnosed, which is a good thing. But there also is a trend for people avoiding gluten, and we think we're in a great position to sort of get into that market and do really well, and the market's only going to grow.
So, see, you said you started sort of properly in January. What would you class as like your main competitors? Would you call it sort of like the main brands that you find in the supermarket, or do you find it to be sort of the more niche craft beers that we used to see in, I don't know, beer festivals, things like that?
It's, in terms of the competition, there aren't many naturally gluten-free beers available. There are people like Greens who are doing some naturally gluten-free now. They also do a range of de-glutenized malted barley beers. There's more and more coming onto the market. I think people are realizing, the big brewers are realizing that there is the market there. So they're starting to, as well as do the malted barley beers, they also start to de-glutenize those and push them out as a gluten-free beer. But I think because we're doing things the right way, we're doing things naturally, some of the de-glutenized malted barley beers do taste a little bit off. And that's because they're taking stuff out.
Hopefully you will get in before those guys. How have you found the 3 days so far?
It's been really good. It's particularly busy today, which I think is not surprising. The sales seem to be better today, and the weather looks pretty good, so I hope that's not keeping people away.
Absolutely. Well, you'll find out at 5 o'clock how hot it is. Where can people find out more information about the company?
We're online at autumnbrewing.co.uk. We're on Twitter and Instagram. We do quite a lot on social media. And people can also buy the beer through the Gluten-Free Beer Store, who are a reasonable-sized outfit over in Melksham. So we're in a fair number of outlets, primarily in the northeast and the northwest. But as I said, we are working on getting into London and getting the brand and the beers out there.
Fantastic. Good luck. And within sort of 5 years, hope to be in the supermarkets?
Potentially, yes, as long as it's supermarkets where we can make a bit of margin.
Obviously, yeah, it's a difficult decision for any company to make, but I mean, good luck with the project and good luck with the rest of the show today.
That's great, thanks Harry.
John Chilton with his interesting beer made out of rice and quinoa. And so we're back now with Danny Kingston, who's the blogger known as the Food Urchin, also probably very well known for his calamities in the garden and digging holes and setting lights.
I'm going to start living vicariously through him.
Exactly. And Luke Fernandez of Sugarwise. So, Luke, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
If we just talk a little bit about you first before we go on to Sugarwise. You're head of policy and public affairs at Sugarwise.
Yeah.
Now, you previously studied classics and yes. classical languages.
Yes.
We have all sorts of people on this show who've all done all sorts of things, anthropology, polity, and they've never done food, have they?
Well, it's interesting where people come from in their backstory, but, you know, it's one of those things that brings...
And so you're sort of literature and linguistics at Cambridge University, and you've got a master's in history, obviously.
Yeah. And now intellectual history, actually, it's a slightly
intellectual history.
What is that?
It's history for smart people, I think.
I always get that question, and it is a difficult question to answer, but it's really the history of philosophy.
Ah, I see. Okay, and then you're now working at Sugarwise. So just to explain to people who don't know what Sugarwise is, it's a certification scheme for sugar. And actually what it does is if you see the Sugarwise logo on a product, it helps you understand exactly what the content of that product is, as opposed to, one might say, yeah. what the manufacturer is claiming. So what you're yeah. trying to do is make it easy for people to understand exactly what is in there. So can you just explain in a bit more detail exactly what you look at in your certificate. I can never say that.
Certification.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Scheme.
You're a great double act, I think. Yeah. Well, actually, you've summarised it really well, I think. It's about being a trusted certification that people can rely on when they're looking for something that's good from a sugar perspective. And we know a lot of people now are living or choosing to live sugar-free lifestyles or lower sugar lifestyles in response to the massive consensus evidence about the harm of consuming sugar, especially so-called free sugars. Now, to go into a little more detail on this, which I think, Sue, you wanted, we focus on free sugars because the World Health Organization focuses on free sugars. So a lot of people are familiar with refined sugars and non-refined sugars and that distinction.
But actually, so refined sugars being, I open a packet of Tate and Lyle and it's white and I put a teaspoon of that in my tea. That's refined sugar.
Versus treacly molasses that has all sorts of other things in it that's less processed. Now, your body sort of treats those as the same, bluntly. Although, you know, there may be other positive attributes to the molasses, ultimately it's a free sugar as well. It gets absorbed into the body very quickly, into the bloodstream. It's not held together by fiber or cellular structure, so it gets absorbed very quickly. And those sugars are harmful, and according to the World Health harmful when consumed in excess, and according to the World Health Organization, should be limited to no more than 5% of a person's daily calorie intake. So
kind of put that in perspective, I believe that's about 6 teaspoons of sugar, about 25 grams or so.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not a lot overall.
So what we're saying is that no sugar is not necessarily bad. No sugar is not necessarily good for you. It's making sure that keep a watch on the amount of refined sugar that you have and try and keep it in perspective, so to speak.
Yes.
So you're not saying to somebody, don't have that chocolate. Yeah. You're saying just have one or two and leave it at that for the day.
Yeah, I should say... refined sugar is not the issue. Like it's free sugars, and it's hard to get people to accept the distinction between free and non-free because, of course, we're also used to the distinction between refined and non-refined.
So, what's free sugars?
Free sugars basically are not contained within the cell wall or don't have any kind of structure that slows their absorption into the bloodstream. So, a classic example of non-free sugars would be dates and raisins. And we certify lots of products that are sweetened by dried, raisins, dried apricots, dates, and so on.
So, you would call those some. I'm getting a bit confused here. So you would call those non-free sugars.
Yes. So, what's an example of a free sugar?
Honey. So, a lot of people think honey is better than sugar. What people need to watch out for, and that's really why Sugarwise is here, to educate people and make sure choices are available. you know, people do get confused on this. They think that honey is much better than table sugar.
But from an actual, I made some mead yesterday. I emptied about 5 jars of honey in there, so
yeah,
that's just set the alarm bells ringing in my head. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
No. It's a good, like, because there is a lot of confusion.
Yeah,
and especially with not just honey, it's agave syrup as well.
So what you're saying is that those would appear to be natural. I'm suggesting because it's bees.
Yeah,
would appear to be natural.
Yeah,
but even though it's a natural product.
Yeah.
It does the same to you inside your body as a couple of teaspoons of white granulated sugar.
Yeah. Now, it's important to say that there may be other positive attributes honey that aren't related to sugar.
Sure.
So there are things in honey that I'm told are good for you. And that's a separate issue, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
But from a sugar perspective, how much sugar there is, it's very similar to any other kind of sugar syrup.
And then we have these non-free sugars,
which
again are natural products, but they don't upset your body and give you these spikes in blood sugar as much as the refined sugars.
Exactly.
So if you've got some children, for example, and I remember thinking to my kids, they quite like a little bit of sweetness sometimes. Mm. We're really, really used to restrict, chocolate and all that sort of stuff. But to give them a handful of raisins or something like that is a good way to give them that slight sugar hit. Is it better for them?
Absolutely. There are some questions over from the dental health, oral health perspective.
Yep.
But in general, in terms of nutrition, much, much better than anything containing free sugars. And absolutely a healthy choice in our view.
And what about this big debate about fruit juice?
Fruit juice is also considered to be high in free sugars.
Right.
And a lot of people are disappointed to learn that because, unfortunately, you know, we all love fruit juice. We all love its taste. Well, most of us love its taste. I don't know.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that needs to be limited as well. And it is important that we get that message across. Some brands do use fruit juice concentrate to sweeten their product. And it depends on the amount, whether we're able to certify those products.
And so are those the kind of things that you're looking for then? When you're certifying a product, say this has what would you call it first, actually, in terms of...
Lower in free sugars.
No, I was
sorry.
No, that's fine. When something carries the SugarWise mark, what is that saying to a consumer of the product?
Right. Every SugarWise mark goes alongside an EU sugar claim. So that's an existing claim in law that we also test. So we test that it's lower in free sugars using a patent-pending proprietary test that we've developed, a year ago, actually, with our chief scientist. It was developed by our chief scientist. And then we also test for... whether it complies with these EU sugar claims.
An EU sugar claim is what? You're allowed to put a stamp on your product if it conforms to some EU legislation in terms of the amount of sugar that the sugar content it is.
Yeah, so one of those claims
So you're in essence, what you're doing is you're verifying the fact
that
it is meeting
the
EU
verifying
the guidelines.
Fact and then providing an additional reassurance on every claim that it's lower in free sugars.
Okay, I get you. We've had a few guests on this program and with some really interesting products. So, for example, Jim Jams spreads.
Yeah.
And now he's an incredible guy. And what he's been trying to do is develop a chocolate spread to rival Nutella, I'm suggesting, that has really reduced that sugar content.
Yeah.
You know, and he's done so well in trying to combat that.
Yeah.
And surely it's very helpful for somebody like him from a marketing perspective that he can get a mark like yours that will show that to parents.
Well, Jim Jams is actually already SugarWise certified.
Yeah.
So, you know, we love Jim Jams. I think, our founder, Rend, appeared demoing Jim Jams to an audience of 10-year-olds or something. And they loved it. They couldn't distinguish it from the market leader. So it was...
And that's what you're trying to aim for, surely, is to try and I suppose, reward I'm thinking of, but also help people in their marketing in terms of getting quite a complicated message across that it's a good, you know, alternative.
I mean, we've even, you know, wanted to get to the bottom of the detail so we can understand it. I mean, Sue and I, obviously not experts in the field of, you know, sugar and EU regulations and stuff. And it is a complex kind of idea. So this idea of there's something you can stamp on the side of your product that is, you know, it is a way to easily communicate this thing has met a certain standard, and so that is
that consumers can trust.
Exactly, it's a trustworthy thing.
And does the mark explain that there's not too much sugar, or does it explain that it's got the right type of sugar, or have I just asked a really difficult question?
There's a sugar-free claim as well, an EU claim, and that will be, you know, that will be on products that can be described as sugar-free. So it depends on the claim, actually. For those who are particularly, I mean, for diabetics, for instance, our mark is not, you know, it would be a case by case. Diabetics would have to look at each product on a case by case basis. Our mark, I presume, would be helpful, but it's not a guarantee, because, of course, diabetics have to be very, very careful. And they couldn't consume something with raisins, for instance. For those who do need zero sugar products, it is helpful, and they can check our verified sugar, the fact that it's been verified by us, and know that it has.
But like most things, though, it depends on your portion control. suggesting that Jim Jams is fine if you have the recommended, you know, amount to put on you know, a piece of toast. But if you were to actually tuck into the whole jar, then the sugar claim probably isn't a good one.
Probably not. Yeah, I mean, it's funny when you look at some of the serving suggestions on the back of a packet. We were talking a couple of weeks ago. We had Dalston Cola in, and we were chatting afterwards about the, you know, the serving suggestions that you look at on the back of a market leading cola brand, and it's got, like, you know, two or three servings in this single bottle or can, you just go, well, who is only drinking a third of it or half of it and putting it back?
Serving can be very...
It's very confusing.
I would say, though, with Jim Jams, you could have the whole thing and you'd probably be well under any kind of sugar. I mean, it's just on another planet compared to...
No, I agree. I mean, it probably wasn't a very good example. But what I'm saying is, though, you do have to watch the helping levels and what they're suggesting is a serving, because actually that can be a bit disingenuous sometimes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But certainly the products we certify from a sugar perspective, I mean, one serving of our product gets you, you know, a tiny fraction of a serving of you know, a market-leading product. Yeah. That doesn't comply, that doesn't, you know, have any, is not working to reduce their sugar content.
And what's your view on the sugar tax? Is that going to absolutely alter the market? Are you seeing people developing things, you know, the bigger boys? What's your view? How will it affect?
Well, you know, the so-called soft drinks industry levy is already targeting a sector that's done so much for reformulation and for sugar reduction. So in a sense, it's a... I believe there have been efforts to reformulate, but it, you know, that, I mean, Coca-Cola, you know, already did its Coke Life and you know, put out its Coke Zero Sugar product, and, you know, at least soft drinks do have lower sugar options available, and there's some evidence that people don't get the majority of their sugar from soft drinks, but from processed foods, ready meals that have a lot of added sugar.
It's astonishing sometimes that, like, cheap bread can have the most amazing amount of sugar in.
And I mean, one of the other guests that we've had before was Mr. Lee's Noodles, and I see that they are Sugarwise certified, and they're a savory product, you know, a noodle, instant noodle kind of thing. And so it's crazy to think that if you bought a different noodle brand, then you could be exposed to these massive amounts of free sugars. It's kind of
absolutely
crazy.
Absolutely. It's frightening.
I once shot this television ad. I won't even remotely explain why, but it, I was a marketing director at a charity, and we were, you know, the government was one of our key clients.
Yeah.
And they wanted to do some stuff around fast food litter. So we hit on this. I don't know how we did it. We hit on this idea that we should be focusing on rats, you know, and vermin. The fact that more litter is around, more fast food litter and stuff like that, is encouraging, you know, sort of rats to reproduce at a rate of this.
I think they do that anyway.
Yeah, but what we were trying to do is get the point across, you know, that there's loads and loads of fast food litter out there. We went and got some McDonald's, right? And while we had a whole studio full of rats, it was absolutely disgusting,
for
a whole day to film this advert. And I didn't realise that rats are completely incontinent. So basically they just wee all day.
Is that true? Are they
yes, they're completely
medically
incontinent.
Defined as incontinent?
Well, I don't know what you call it, but basically they just wee the whole time.
Right, yeah. Okay, and they don't, there's no...
No, they just, that's what they do. They don't save it up like we do. No,
how much time are giving to this?
Yeah, sorry about that.
People have pet rats, though,
which is why you should never drink. Which is why you should never drink beer out of a bottle, because all of the places where bottles are stored, generally rats are running up and down over them. So that's why I always have...
terrible news.
That's why I always have beer in a glass. Just add that. Anyway, so we had this whole room full of rats these cages, and we just threw these McDonald's burgers in for them. We were shooting, you know, the camera. They were not interested in the meat at all. All they went for was the bread.
And because I was saying to them,
had all the sugar in it. Right. They love it. They absolutely loved it. Yeah. And the sugar content of it was huge. Now it may not be now because that was a while ago, but it was. And I think adding sugar would just became so endemic as a natural thing to do. And I do think it has made people look at adding sugar. I'm sure it won't be as high like that now, but it used to be.
Yeah, and I think, sugar does have a lot of advantages when it comes to preserving food and making food more palatable, especially if you reduce the fat and salt content, as manufacturers have been doing over the past few decades. But actually, there's more consensus over sugar as being harmful than there is consensus about either salt or fat. And so I chuckled a bit when you said sugar was controversial, because actually,
it's not very controversial
at all, because all the evidence is against sugar.
Yeah.
So we just need to act now, because we know. It's not like fat, actually.
Mm.
Well, I was going to say one of the things that other than having this this SugarWise mark that you can put on to get the certification, we've talked a bit about the sugar tax, which I guess is taking one approach to, you know, change people's perceptions and stuff. But one thing that you guys seem to be keen to do is to not punish sugar, but to try and make it easier and cheaper to eat healthy. And can you tell us a little bit about your campaign that you have in that area?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I alluded to it a little earlier, that actually the soft drinks industry is doing the most, and they're being punished, which we're not really too keen on. I mean, we want manufacturers to be given more of a carrot when they do the right thing, rather than to have the stick kind of.
Yeah, but it's
not
great
sure
story.
What the expression would be.
That's what politicians love.
With the stick. I don't know.
But politicians love it because it looks like they're doing something.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Mm. But you're trying to encourage there to be a reduction in VAT for low sugar products.
Yes, and anyone listening can go to Don't Tax Healthy, hashtag Don't Tax Healthy. They can Google it and go to our website and register their support. We want VAT cut on products that are doing the right thing.
So you want it the other way around, which is very sensible, really. Don't tax the bad stuff. Give financial incentives for the good stuff. And actually,
absolutely, yeah.
Corporates, or do both. But corporates will always go for something if it's going to save them money, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or give them a market advantage because you know it's going
to
be cheaper.
And it's more than, I mean, we also want the government to push retailers to list more lower sugar products. I mean, they're already all over the shelves, but retailers can do more, and government can do more to ease the process along. So it's not just the tax system, it's the whole ecosystem around this needs to be fixed.
Mm. And why exactly is sugar so bad for you? You know, what is it that's bad? I mean, if we just forget the tooth decay element.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that is something that you can forget when you're talking about why sugar is bad.
I know it's part of it. But some people will say that actually sugar isn't an issue for your teeth if you clean your teeth properly and regularly. So I don't know whether that's true or not. But in terms of what happens in your body, is it to do with blood sugar levels? Is that what happens?
So.
It just spikes your blood sugar all the time.
I mean, as you mentioned before, I'm a classicist, not a scientist. But we could you know, talk about this for ages, but it's basically it does spike your blood glucose levels. And causes an increase in fat stores, as I understand it, and that's been the consensus position for a long time, and free sugars do this, you know, the most violently, and so it directly, I mean, it's a major factor in creating the obesity epidemic that we're now seeing. And one concern is that life expectancy may be reduced in succeeding generations, and possibly, you know, our children may live shorter lives than we will just because of sugar. Now, that's a very contentious claim, but it has been made. And, you know, the fact that it's been made shows how desperate the situation is.
And yet governments have successively, you know, and all sorts of other organisations have been telling us that, you know, low fat is good. And fat was the demon.
Yeah,
really.
A lot of that, I think, was back in the day, it was originally peddled by the American Sugar Association, or I can't remember the specific name, but they were, you know, creating all sorts of, you know, false research to try and say that sugar was actually good for you, and it was even a weight loss thing at one stage. This is what they were trying to say, but, you know, they're trying to, you know, divert the blame elsewhere to make people, you know, victimise, you know, fat. So then low fat stuff became this really popular thing.
Yeah.
It's a crazy
Ansel story. Keys, the inventor of the Mediterranean diet, I think was partly responsible for that as well.
And then, of course, now demonizing carbohydrates is the latest thing.
Yeah. And a lot of people are kind of jumping on that and going, well, I guess there's also sugar in carbohydrates, or sugar is a form of carbohydrate, I guess, depending on how you want to look at it. But, but yeah, and then people are seem more happy to, you know, just completely cut out the bread. And cut out all carbohydrates, which is not necessarily the healthiest option.
I read somewhere, but I don't think it's true, I don't know, that a lot of adults take their sugar intake through wine and booze.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think I'm definitely in that camp.
Yeah, because I don't eat sugary stuff at all.
You didn't need to bring that up, really.
However,
it's funny.
Wine is, you know, it's got a shed loads of sugar in it.
Mm. I mean, I've actually been working with a personal trainer for the last bit months.
I didn't notice.
Thanks, Sue. And one of the first things he said was, you know, cut out the booze, because we were keeping a food diary and I was having, you know, a glass or several every night. And, you know, he said that is one sure way to, you know, to drop the weight, because it's got so much sugar in it. So just cut out the booze, you know, cut out the carbs in the evening, but not throughout the rest of the day. Mm. And you'll do good.
Has it worked for you? I was only joking. I don't really look at you, to be honest. not in that way. Anyway.
Well, now you've thrown me. I haven't taken any measurements recently, but yeah, no, it definitely feels like it's doing a good thing, even though I really quite fancy a glass of wine.
I would encourage winemakers listening to this program to get in touch with Sugarwise and maybe reformulate their products. You know, organic wine hasn't really taken off because of taste issues. And I think lower sugar wine is going to be even more difficult for them to get right. So I'd love for them to do
it. Are there any Sugarwise wines?
I don't believe so. You know, as with organic wine, it's more difficult sector to really provoke into reformulation, I think. But it's definitely something we'll look into
really
and try to encourage.
We will happily drink your Sugarwise wines.
Do you get loads of sugar in vodka and gin? You don't, do you?
There's a lot of sugar in spirits, even
is
though.
There?
I'm not a spirits expert. I don't even know what I am an expert in these days. But I think all alcohol tends to carry a fairly large amount of sugar, which, you know, is carbohydrate as well. So
Luke, obviously trying to get people to remove sugar, you know, if we can, and not to affect taste. But what about artificial sweeteners? Lot of people are saying that really upsets your gut badly. And actually, that is a real demon. It's probably worse than having sugar. Have you got any views?
Well, I think to all the people listening out there, you know, it's... when you look at the names of these things, erythritol, xylitol, sucralose, they sound pretty scary. But from our perspective, there's no reason to avoid, you know, sweeteners. I acknowledge that there is conflicting evidence, but the relevant authorities have been looking at this for decades and decades and decades. Aspartame, which is an innovative sweetener, has been studied repeatedly, and there have been so many tests on it since the early 1970s. So I acknowledge people have concerns, but really, you know, it's more of a perception issue. It's that they sound funny, they don't seem natural, and thus people are scared.
They're called artificial sweeteners.
Yeah.
So I mean, that doesn't really help, does it? Because by its nature, you go, well, they're artificial then.
But even some of them, which are from natural sources like stevia, is, you know, it's been, even though stevia is a plant, it's a herb, you know, a lot of time it's been processed into something through a very heavily chemical process.
Absolutely. And, you know, the distinction between artificial and natural is a sort of very tenuous one anyway. I mean, you know, sugar's been processed from sugarcane to get it to be,
true,
you know, in its in its granular form. And, you know, if you look at the sugar alcohols like xylitol and erythritol, they come from birch, you know, they're tapped from birch sap often. And they're not, you know, they're not artificial in the way that we would traditionally think of artificial. But
so for you, it's still better to give your child, you know, a Diet Coke than a Coke?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question. And, you know, the weight of evidence against free sugars is so damning. And considering the lack of evidence for harm of any of the sweeteners in Diet Coke, I don't think there's any rational way you can say that Coke is better for you than Diet Coke.
That's interesting, because there was a big thing that came out I want to say it was a few months ago, but I may be getting my dates wrong. And there was this, you know, big front page headlines about how there were all these some new research had come out proving that Coke Zero or Diet Coke or one of the other diet soda brands, they were proving all these negative claims. And then a couple of weeks later, somebody came out and said they completely read the research wrong, and that was a load of nonsense, and this hasn't been proven yet.
Do you know, public are so confused because
and no wonder
so
they're confused
much rubbish.
Because there's so much nonsense out there.
Yeah,
I'm sure we're even partly responsible for some of it.
But and conflicting, and it's very hard, particularly as a parent, to find your way through it. I think, and try and understand what choices you can make, because you know, as Luke said when he started, we'd love everybody to cook from scratch every day, and you know, I try very hard to do that, but when you're busy you don't always, and that's when you have to make those choices.
Absolutely.
and it's so difficult to understand, because the noise about it is so conflicting.
I think it always comes back to that, you know, balanced approach of, you know, we can try and make, you know, try and educate ourselves as much as possible, which is what, you know, we try to do here on this show, what Danny is also doing, and, you know, in his writing, what we do on the Food Rush, you know, try to give people as much information in as simple a way as possible so that they can make those better educated choices.
And not tell people what
to do. But also, not be dogmatic about it and say, you must do this, you must do that. Because, you know, people are people, and people want, and life is to be lived. But, you know, having the choices and having the information is the most important thing. So you
Absolutely.
Can choose.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and make an informed decision. Well, that's all been jolly interesting and very thought-provoking, actually. If you want to find out more about SugarWise, you need to go on to sugarwise.org. Loads and loads of information there. There's some interesting, there's like an interactive presentation that explains the project in more detail on their website, and that's definitely worth looking at, especially if you've got children and you are very interested in you know, how you might limit their sugar intake. So thank you very much, Luke Fernandez of SugarWise. And of course, the wonderful, wonderful Danny Kingston from Food Urchin. Make sure and don't go around your house, Danny. It's fraught with danger.
But the food is great.
The food is great.
So,
so thank you, guys, for joining us. You've been listening to the Food Talk Show with me, Sue Nelson, and my fellow presenter, Guy Routledge. You can hear our show on numerous radio stations now. We've got so many, we don't even care to mention them all. All across the world, California, Kent, Michigan, Malta, Manchester, I mean, you name it. If you want to download any of our hundreds of podcasts now, go to foodtalk.co.uk. Or if you want to suggest an amazing guest, that would be good. We're always happy to look at anybody that any of you think is interesting, doing something different. Then just tweet us on @FoodTalkShow. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll hope to catch you next week.
See you later.
Thank you.